Well, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, December 2nd. Yes, it is December 2nd, Wednesday. And we have one more week of school besides the lecture for today, which means then that a week from today is your last exam. We'll call it a final exam, but you know it's not a cumulative exam. It's just over a few chapters. And let's take a look at what chapters those are. What chapters are going to be on the exam? I guess I got to go back and find the syllabus. So indeed, the last exam, December 9th, that's 1 week from today. We're in chapter 24. We're going to finish that up today. We're just a little bit ahead of schedule. Then we're going to go into chapter 25 today. And one more lecture on that on Monday, and then Wednesday lecture exam on 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. And you have really good study guides for all of those, and probably you've all looked through all that material already, and you're almost ready for the test after you study over the weekend. So that will be fantastic. The other thing that's happening next week is your last practicum, practicum number 4. And for those of you that have Wednesday lab, you're scheduled to have the practicum and the lecture exam on the same day. The morning lab before the lecture exam, the afternoon lab after the lecture exam. But remember, you all are welcome to take the practicum on Monday if you want to. And you can take it at 8 o'clock or 12:35. And I think I'll have room for everybody in there. If not, then I don't know what I'm going to do. All right, so the Wednesday lab, you certainly can take the practicum on Monday if you wish. And that way you only have the lecture exam to do. But you have some other things. Let's see, the Wednesday group has to take quiz number 10, which is the reproductive system. And quiz number 10 has a picture, it's labeling only of the male reproductive system and the female reproductive system. And that's 25.1, 25.11, that's the 10th quiz. And then everybody has the remediation exam to take, if you want. That's extra credit. And also the extra credit assignment drawing the structural and functional unit of urine formation. That's for 10 points. So you have to take all of those if you want credit for it before the end of the semester. So that means sometime after the last lab Wednesday, a week from today. And a lot of people have been taking those quizzes already, getting them out of the way. So that seems a little complicated. Does anybody have any questions on the schedule as far as what you have to do before the semester's over? No questions about that? Okay, so the Monday labs are well ahead of schedule compared to the Wednesday, all right, because they're pretty much done with everything. Just the Wednesday group, because of that holiday, kind of got behind. Plus, they're the second lab of the week as well. All right, any questions on the schedule whatsoever? And what you should be studying for the last exam. We're good. I don't see any hands or anything. Okay. I'll put the schedule away. And so I'm just going to ask you, what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? It is the nephron. Yeah, okay, let me pull up the word slide right here. And you see some slides on the right-hand side. And so we're looking at an illustration from the kidney, and I see the cortical, and I see the arcuate artery and arcuate vein. That's an important landmark in the kidney, because what is it separating? Let's see how you guys are doing with your studying. What are these arcuate vessels separating? Yeah, the renal cortex, which is in this region, from the renal medulla, right? And branching off of the arcuate artery is the cortical radiate artery, that shoots up into the cortex, and off of the cortical radiate artery, you have the afferent arteriole bringing blood into the glomerulus, right? So that's the beginning of the nephron. And on this slide, you see that there are basically two kinds of nephrons, right? Just by their shape, cortical nephrons have a loop of Henle that just barely make it down into the medulla, just a very short distance. And so we call these cortical nephrons. It has all the tubular elements and vascular elements of a regular nephron. And so they have peritubular capillaries around the tubular elements. And then over here on the right-hand side, we have a nephron that has all the same components, but the loop of Henle now diverts very deep into the medulla of the kidney. And we're going to call this the juxtamedullary nephron. Its job is a little bit different than a cortical nephron. The juxtamedullary nephron can produce very small amounts of urine that will help you conserve water, help you maintain water in your body, that is highly concentrated. So it can concentrate salt or solutes in urine. And that's really handy when you're dehydrating. There are peritubular capillaries around the loop of Henle, but notice that they are very straight. And we'd like to give them a different name other than peritubular capillaries. We'd like to call these the vasa recta, because they're very straight and they follow very closely along in a linear fashion right up against the walls of the descending and ascending loop of Henle. All right, so those are the two kinds of nephrons, and a little bit of difference between the peritubular capillaries of the cortical and juxtamedullary nephrons. All right, any questions on that? And you got all your vascular elements down, tubular elements down, the correct order, and the three processes. One thing I didn't mention last time, in the vascular elements, in particular the peritubular capillaries, the endothelium of the peritubular capillary, can sense low oxygen concentration. So there are chemoreceptors in that part of the vascular element, and when there's low oxygen concentration, these cells release erythropoietin. And erythropoietin is a hormone. It goes into the blood, and it goes everywhere the blood goes, in particular to red bone marrow. What do you know about red bone marrow? What can it do for us, red bone marrow? There's two kinds. There's yellow bone marrow and red bone marrow. Red bone marrow is responsible for making red blood cells. Yellow bone marrow is just a storage area for lipid or fat, an important energy source, but red is important for making red blood cells. And just to review, how many red blood cells do you lose every second in your body? About 2 million. Yeah, no joke. You lose a lot. So, how many red blood cells do you have to make every second? 2 million. Otherwise, you become anemic, right? And the hormone that helps regulate that production so it matches up with the loss of red blood cells is erythropoietin. So, it's a hormone that comes from the kidney, goes to red bone marrow, stimulates red blood cell production when oxygen concentration decreases in the blood. Right. This was a difficult hormone to find at one point in time, and so bacteria were instructed how to make that particular hormone. And the genetically modified or the genetically made hormone is called EPO, which is what we can administer to people. It's a very cheap form, but it's actually the human form of erythropoietin. It's very effective, but now bacteria produce that for us in a test tube, which is really handy, EPO. So what does EPO do? If you get a shot of EPO, what is that going to do for you? It's going to stimulate red blood cell production, right, when somebody is anemic. So it's an important hormone. All right, so I wanted to make sure that you mentioned that you saw that. All right, well, there's one last item that I haven't talked about, and so let me find this. It's called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so let's look at some tubular elements. Let's zoom into this part of the figure. I see Bowman's capsule with a glomerulus inside of it, and here's a squiggly tube, which we're going to call the, what is this squiggly tube right here? Proximal convoluted tubule, and then we have, go ahead and tell me this one here, descending loop, ascending loop, and then what is this squiggly line? That's the distal convoluted tubule. We haven't seen this particular arrangement before, but it's very important. The distal convoluted tubule, as it's winding around, always winds right up to Bowman's capsule, and it passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. It passes right between them in every single nephron, doesn't matter which one. And so that area right here is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So let's zoom into this region. And here is that nice zoomed in region. I can see the glomerulus with some red blood cells in there. All right, and then here is the parietal division of Bowman's capsule. Here's the visceral division, right? These podocytes with foot processes on them. And so here's the glomerulus. And what kind of fluid do we have in Bowman's capsule right here? Yeah, it's filtrate, right? And that filtrate is there because there is plasma that is filtered through the glomerulus and these foot processes to produce that fluid. And then that fluid moves from Bowman's capsule into the next tube, which is, and I see it right here, that is the proximal convoluted tubule. Yeah, so you should have that list of tubular elements, and it would lead you right to the right name for this thing. All right, so here's Bowman's capsule. Here is the afferent arteriole, and I see there are some cells that surround it. These cells remind me of a precapillary sphincter. Remember, a precapillary sphincter is at the origin of every capillary bed, and it can constrict, cutting off blood to a capillary, or if that tissue needs a blood supply, that precapillary sphincter dilates and allows blood to flow into that tissue, bringing in oxygen, washing away carbon dioxide and other kinds of metabolites that might be harmful to those cells. And these cells right here are what we call granular cells of the afferent arteriole. And notice that the efferent arteriole doesn't have them. They're only on the afferent arteriole. And then here is the distal convoluted tubule passing right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. And the epithelium of this part of the distal convoluted tubule has some cells that we call macula densa cells. And these macula densa cells can monitor blood volume and also solute concentration, or the saltiness of blood. The granular cells can measure blood pressure. And when blood pressure declines, these granular cells can secrete an enzyme into the blood called renin. And the bottom line is, we're not going to go into the whole mechanism, but the bottom line, when renin is secreted into the blood from these granular cells right here, that is going to increase blood pressure. All right, so these cells are sensitive to a decrease in blood pressure. They secrete a compound called renin, which will increase blood pressure back up to what it should be under normal circumstances. Okay. When blood volume decreases or the saltiness of blood increases, then the macula densa cells can signal the granular cells also to secrete renin, which is going to increase blood pressure. So this is one of the most important areas in your body that is involved in long-term regulation of blood pressure. Not short-term, not when you change body position, when you stand up from lying down or sitting down, right? But day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month is due to regulation here of the juxtaglomerular apparatus and a cascade of events that's triggered by renin, right, from these granular cells. Secrete renin when blood pressure falls. When renin is secreted, it will increase blood pressure. Right, so that's most important for regulating long-term blood pressure. Now, what do you know about regulation of blood pressure in the long term? Do people have problems with that? Is there a pathology? Is it epidemic? I would say it is. What do we call that? That disease process? That is hypertension. That's right. That is hypertension. And so hypertension, we think there are a number of different causes, but we think it has something to do with this juxtaglomerular apparatus and renin and some of the other compounds that are associated with renin. When we get into a physiology class, we're really going to be interested in that whole mechanism and how to manipulate that mechanism to help bring somebody's blood pressure back down to normal. Right, because some of the consequences of high blood pressure is that it destroys capillaries, including in the kidney. So it's going to kill a kidney. It's going to kill capillaries in the heart, in the brain, and all over your body. So hypertension is a very serious disease, very, very serious disease. And it really needs to be controlled. If you know somebody with hypertension, you really have to help them out in taking their medication properly so that their blood pressure is controlled. Otherwise, it's a deadly disease. And some of the things that it kills, like I said, are the kidneys and the heart, and these are important organs that you cannot live without. All right, so that, I think, is the last part of the urinary system. Oh, no, there's one last thing. I didn't go over the blood supply, major blood vessels going to a kidney. So let's find these major blood vessels. Major blood vessels, here's a kidney, okay. And probably where I want to start is that quiz figure. that you had to label in lab. And it is right here someplace. All right, so we're familiar, right? So maybe somebody has to take this quiz today, even in the afternoon lab. So here's a nice sagittal section, not a sagittal section, more of a coronal section of a kidney. And I can see the fibrous capsule on the outside that helps stabilize the kidney. And then here's the superficial region of the kidney, and any superficial region of an organ we call the cortex. Right, and then down below the cortex, deep to the cortex, is the medulla. Right, the medulla is any deep part of an organ. So I see kind of a lot of homogeneity in the cortex. I don't see a lot of different kinds of structures. It all looks pretty similar. But when I look in the medulla, I see two major kinds of structures. Right, I see these triangular or pyramidal-shaped structures, which we call pyramids, and in between the pyramids, we see columns. Inside the pyramids, we have nephrons, which is the structural functional unit of urine formation. But in the columns, we have major blood vessels. That's pretty much the big difference. So the pyramids are producing urine, and that urine ends up in a collecting duct, and it weeps out of the tip of the pyramid right here into this collecting basin that we call a calyx, right? A minor calyx. So here's a minor calyx, here's a minor one. Minor calyces join together to form this major. Major calyces form together to make this funnel-shaped structure, which is what we call the renal pelvis. And there's urine in all of these different places. The pelvis helps funnel urine into the ureter, which takes it to what organ? The ureter takes urine to the urinary bladder, right, that stores urine until there's a proper time to void, because the job of the kidney is to produce urine, and it has to do so every second. It can't ever stop. If the kidney ever stops producing urine, then it's on its way to dying. So that we don't ever want to see, right? Kidneys producing urine all the time. All right, well, what I wanted to get to were blood vessels, blood supply to the kidney. And the kidney vessels belong to the systemic circulation. If it's a systemic artery, what color should it be if it's systemic? Or should it be high in oxygen or low in oxygen? Either way, what do you want to tell me about that? High in oxygen, systemic artery, high or low in oxygen? High, right. So systemic arteries are high in oxygen. What kind of arteries are low in oxygen? Those would be the pulmonary arteries, right? And we're not talking about pulmonary. We're still talking about urinary system here. So this red blood vessel is an artery of the systemic circulation, bringing oxygenated blood into the kidney. And it bifurcates. As soon as it enters this region of the kidney that we call the hilus or the hilum, right? The hilum is the area on a kidney where there are blood vessels that can enter or leave, where urine can leave, where there's a nerve that enters the kidney. So this is the hilus right here. These things cannot enter or leave the kidney in any other location other than the hilus. All right, so the renal artery comes in, and it's going to bifurcate into arteries that we call segmental arteries. They're going to different segments of the kidney, and then they bifurcate once again, and they course through the columns. People have a tendency to think that these pyramids are very similar to lobes of the kidney, and so the vessels that are between the lobes of the kidney are called the interlobar vessels, and in particular arteries, since that's what we're talking about. All right, so let me see right here. This is nice. All right, a little bit zoomed in region. So we've dissected the kidney just a little bit differently, so we can see the renal artery very nice. That first bifurcation, I can see a segmental artery and a segmental artery. The segmental artery goes up into the column between the pyramids, and no longer do we call that a segmental artery. We're going to call that an interlobar artery. So we got renal, segmental, interlobar, and then that goes all the way to the cortex, or the line that separates the cortex from the medulla at the base of a pyramid, and these are what we call the arcuate arteries. All right, so we got renal, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, and then coming off the arcuate arteries, going shining up into the cortex, those are what we call the cortical radiate arteries. And off the cortical radiate arteries is a vessel that you're familiar with already. That is the afferent arteriole. So afferent arteriole comes off of these cortical radiate arteries. All right, so on the way back then, coming out of the nephron, blood goes into a venule. The venule empties into a cortical radiate vein, which empties into an arcuate vein, which empties into an interlobar vein, and that interlobar vein goes all the way to the renal vein. There are not segmental veins in the kidney. That's one thing that is skipped. All right, so that's really what I just wanted to mention right now. So if we look at that circulatory pattern, right, aorta, you got ascending aorta, arch of the aorta, descending aorta, then you go all the way down past the thoracic descending part into the abdominal descending part, then the renal arteries are a branched pair coming off the aorta, and then they enter the kidney through the hilus. When it bifurcates, it turns into segmental. These segmentals then course between the pyramids, so we call those the interlobar. Then it gets to the base of a pyramid, we call those the arcuate arteries. And from there, the cortical radiate arteries originate, go up into the cortex, and from these cortical radiate arteries, that's where we have these afferent arterioles, right? And can you remember, afferent arteriole brings blood to a glomerulus, then an efferent arteriole. And that efferent arteriole is going to take blood to another capillary, because that's the job of an arteriole, and we call them the peritubular capillaries. It is true if it's a cortical nephron, but if it's a juxtamedullary nephron, what do we call these peritubular capillaries? We call it the vasorecta, right? So they're a little bit different in structure, and vasorecta with the Lupa Henle is very special because it can produce very small amounts of urine that are highly concentrated in salt, a lot different than the mixture of salt that is in our body, a lot different. So it takes a special effort to do that. All right, so then after these peritubular capillaries, then it goes into a venule, back into a cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein. Can you picture where that arcuate vein is? Right at the base of a pyramid, then into an interlobar vein between the pyramids, and then directly into the renal vein. There's no segmental vein right here. Renal vein empties into the inferior vena cava, taking it back to the heart. So that's the blood supply. Maybe the first time you look at it, it seems a little complicated, but it's not too bad if you look at it a couple times, right? The only trick is veins. There's no segmental vein. All right, so now I think that is everything that I wanted to say about the urinary system. All right, so the kidney is really important. Not only does it produce urine, get rid of waste products for us, but it helps regulate blood pressure because of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It also helps regulate red blood cell production because it secretes a hormone, erythropoietin. So the kidney is an endocrine gland as well. So it's a very fascinating kind of organ. Any questions on the kidney? Any questions at all? No? You're pretty good with that? You know how to draw that out? Should we draw the nephron out once again? What about the three processes for producing urine? I can't remember if we went over that or not, the three processes. Be nice if I had a marker. I thought I had some markers here. Okay, let's draw a nephron out. I'm going to go get some markers. Steal them from the classroom next door. That's where I have them. Hello, I'm going to steal some magic markers from the store right here.
Oh, I did not know there was a special staff.
Oh, sorry about that. Excuse me, class. Leave you alone. Oh, my mic was on, right? I could see you guys the whole time. Not really, but you could hear me. Okay, so when we... What is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? That is the nephron, right? So we're going to say nephron right here. All right, nephron, and nephron is made up of a bunch of tubes. We can break all of the tubes down into how many different categories? Two categories, and what are the names of the categories? Tubular elements and vascular elements. So tubular elements, number one, what does a tubular element contain? Filtrate. Tubular element, all right, has filtrate. And so you have to know every tubular element, but also the correct sequence. So if you're going to trace a drop of filtrate through the nephron, you have to know the correct order. So the first part is what? Bowman's capsule. What's in Bowman's capsule? Filtrate. Yeah, filtrate. I wasn't trying to trick anybody. Then fluid is going to flow from Bowman's capsule into a tube that it has a lot of twists and turns to it. It's the closest one to Bowman's capsule, so I heard proximal. Yeah, proximal, and it's very twisty, so it's convoluted. Convoluted tubule. What kind of fluid is in the convoluted tubule? Filtrate. Nice. All right. These things are in the cortex. All right. Now there's a tube that will take filtrate down into the medulla, sometimes just a little bit, sometimes really deep down into the medulla, depending on what kind of nephron it is. And what's the tube that takes filtrate into the nephron? Descending. Loop of Henle. Okay, and then filtrate comes back up out of the medulla into the cortex via the ascending loop of Henle. What kind of fluid is in the ascending loop of Henle? There's filtrate still. All right, and then it's going to go through another convoluted tubule. Can't be the proximal. This is the one that's farthest away, so it is the distal convoluted tubule. And again, it has filtrate in it. And finally, after going through the distal convoluted tubule, ends up in the collecting duct. All right, and what kind of fluid is in the collecting duct? That's right, because it has been processed by all of these tubes right here in association with blood vessels, and now it is urine, and that is a product that is going to be excreted. All right, so those are all the tubular elements, vascular elements, number two. All right, so there's some capillaries in the nephron. We first want to think about a blood vessel that brings blood to a capillary. That is an arteriole. And if it's bringing blood into the nephron, it is the afferent arteriole. All right, so here we got vascular elements. The first one, afferent arteriole. Arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. This one is a special leaky capillary in the kidney. It's a fenestrated capillary, and it's got a special name because of that. It's called the, go ahead, tell me what it's called. Yeah, that sounded pretty good. Glomerulus. Glomerulus, make sure you can pronounce that so you know how to spell it. That is capillary number one. I'm just going to abbreviate that, cap number one. And then, usually, after a capillary, blood is going to flow into what kind of blood vessel? Usually. Not here, but usually it is a venule or a vein, right? You got artery, capillary, vein, but not in the kidney. You've got artery, capillary, and then another blood vessel that we call the efferent arteriole. Efferent arteriole. And it's an efferent arteriole because it's taking blood away from glomerulus, right? Afferent, bringing blood toward glomerulus. And where does an arteriole always bring blood to? Capillaries, more capillaries. So here's a second capillary. These are what we're going to call the peritubular capillaries. And this is capillary number two in that same circulation. All right, now this is for a cortical nephron. There's another kind of nephron. Anybody know a name of another kind of nephron? Juxtamedullary nephron. They have something that's like a peritubular capillary, but it's a little bit different. It exists only in the medulla. What do we call the peritubular capillaries for a juxtamedullary nephron? That's a vasa recta, because they're straight. Recta is straight. Okay, so maybe you want to put vasa recta someplace, just so that you'll have to make sure you go back and look at that, Vasa Recta. Vasa Recta. All right, and then after these peritubular capillaries, then it just goes back to a venule, right? And then back to coracal radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar vein, right? And then no segmental, then renal vein, then inferior vena cava. All right, well, this is what I wanted to get to. Let's put the basic framework of a nephron now on the board. And I typically start with tubular elements. You can start however you like or even put them together. You don't even have to use two different colors like I am doing here, but I think I'm using two different colors. So here is Bowman's capsule. What kind of fluid is in Bowman's capsule? Filtrate. All right, and then here is proximal convoluted tubule. Descending loop of Henle. Ascending loop of Henle. Distal convoluted tubule. And then collecting duct. So what kind of fluid is in Bowman's capsule? PCT, DLH, ALH, DCT. Filtrate. And what's in collecting duct? Urine. Nice. All right, so there's some processing taking place right here. We're going to get to that in a second. All right, so now we got vascular elements. Something bringing blood into a capillary and into Bowman's capsule. Afferent arteriole. Then you have this fancy capillary, very leaky capillary inside Bowman's capsule. That is the glomerulus. Glomerulus. And then here is a blood vessel bringing blood to another capillary, but it's leaving Bowman's capsule. That is the efferent arteriole. And then we have these capillaries that surround, and let's just say that this is a cortical nephron. A cortical nephron, what kind of capillary is that? Peritubular capillary. Let's say this is a juxtamedullary nephron where this loop of Henle goes really deep into the medulla. What are these capillaries then called? Vasa recta. Yeah, vasa recta. And then over here, after that capillary, you will have a what? A venule. Right. Venule goes to cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar vein, renal vein. All right, the three processes. All right, and maybe I'll use blue. All right, there is stuff that's in blood. All right, so I'm going to put a little dot on blood. Do you see I have it on the glomerulus? There's blood in the glomerulus, right? And remember, that capillary is very leaky. Every small molecule has a potential for leaving, whether it's a molecule we want in our body, like glucose, or a harmful molecule, like urea, toxic compound, and even a molecule that we have to have in our body that's small, which is water. All these things will filter out into Bowman's capsule. So I'm going to put a little arrow right here, and I'm going to put that as number one. So molecules move by their size. Large molecules are trapped in this capillary. Small ones can leak out. And so number one process is what we call filtration. That's how you make coffee, tea, other kinds of stuff, right? You put all these big things on one side of a piece of paper, and then only the small ones go through the other side, and then you drink the stuff that has just the small particles, and unless you're French, right? Then you just chew your coffee. All right, so filtration. What does the process of filtration produce? What does it produce? Filtrate, right? Okay. And how does that go? How does material go? Does it go from filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? How does material move from one place to another? It's going to start in blood and end up in filtrate. So here, I'm not sure I did this last time, so write down blood and then an arrow to filtrate. That is a process, process number one. Okay. So we said that all small molecules can be filtered out, even ones that we have to stay alive, like glucose and water. So we're losing a lot of water and a lot of glucose. So there is a method, right, to take water and glucose that's in the filtrate, right? So here is filtrate. Here's filtrate. Do you agree that I put that dot on where we have filtrate? I put it in the wrong spot for a second. All right. I think this has to be a little red right there. All right, so this fluid has been filtered, but there's good things in there, and it's put back into the blood. This is number two. Some of these examples would be glucose. You don't want to lose any glucose. That's an important energy molecule. That's like gasoline in your car. Right? That should stay in your body. So number two is tubular resorption. And how does material move for tubular resorption? Blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? Filtrate to blood, right? Which is opposite filtration. So it goes filtrate to blood. Well, we're two-thirds of the way done. There's one more process. Not all harmful compounds can be filtered. It does a good job of filtering, but it can't filter everything out, right? So if there are harmful compounds that stay in the blood, there is a mechanism to take them from blood and put them into the filtrate. And if they're put into the filtrate, where do they end up, those harmful compounds? Urine, and they're excreted from your body, right? So some of the things would be maybe excess salt, excess acid, right? And even urea that wasn't filtered, it can be taken from the blood right here, which is going to stay in your body, into the filtrate. This is process number three. And process number three over here is what we call tubular secretion. So if something is secreted, how does it move? Blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? If it's secreted. Number three, does that look like a red line? Good. That's blood. Starts in blood. Where does it end up? Filtrate. All right, so here we're going to put in parentheses, blood to filtrate. All right, and after these three processes take place in the nephron, what do we end up with? Urine, right? Urine that doesn't have too much water in it, urine that has no glucose in it, right? Urine that might have a lot of salt in it, if we've eaten a lot of salt in our diet, okay? And it is loaded with toxic compounds like urea, and that's what we get rid of out of our body, right? Those three processes. Okay, anybody got a question about that nephron, the three processes, which direction things go? Pretty good? Yeah, okay. So that's sort of like the diagram you have to draw on the extra credit, but you don't have to draw in these processes, just the basic structure. But for sure, you should know those functions. Okay, so when you go to a physiology class, make sure you know when somebody's talking about filtrate, where is filtrate located? In a vascular element or a tubular element? Tubular element. And if something's in a tubular element, where is it going to end up? Outside your body, right? If something stays in filtrate, it's going to end up outside your body. But if it is resorbed, then it stays in your body. It's resorbed into a blood vessel, right? And so in physiology, we're really interested in all those different processes. All right, so I think that's it for kidney. Okay? All right. Sounds good. So I'm going to put this stuff away. And now for the piece de resistance of the class, which is the diversification system. All right, let me put all this stuff away. Diversification system. Where do we have all that? Okay. Diversification. Here. And then I do want to go here. All right, well, that one slide said what? That one slide said, reproductive system. Well, I've got to ask, what's the purpose of the reproductive system? To create offspring? Yeah, to reproduce? And you know what? That's sort of right, but not really, not in the way that I think. Reproductive system isn't just to make more people, okay? There's something special that's happening there. Right, and I want to pull up this one slide. I had it here just a second ago. Where is it? Here. Okay. All right, so here is, let's see if I can zoom in. It gets a little grainy. All right, but here is a little animal. It's called a hydra. It's a polyp. It has a body tube, and inside that body tube, there's a digestive system, and then the mouth of it is right over here, and then has a bunch of these tentacles. Tentacles have muscle. They can move around in the water. There's stinging cells that line these tentacles, so when something swims by, it gets stung and paralyzed, and then the tentacle puts it in the mouth. It gets digested. All right, so that's a polyp, and that's after it's digested, then it leaves the mouth. So it's kind of a gross organism, right? It's kind of really rudimentary kind of animal. But nonetheless, it lives. When it wants to reproduce, let's look and see what happens. It forms a little bud. That bud gets a little bit longer, right? And then it starts to look like another polyp with some tentacles here and a mouth and a body tube. And this thing grows bigger and bigger and bigger. And when it gets to a certain size, it just pinches off from the parent hydra, and now you have two hydra right there. Right? And so the hydra that was produced was exactly like the parent. So that is a form of reproduction, right? We started with one hydra, we ended up with two, but the hydra are exactly the same. We call that asexual reproduction. Asexual reproduction. All right? That's not how humans reproduce. Right, here is another example of asexual reproduction. Here's that hydra with a little bud, and then the bud grows, and it's almost like an adult, finally pinches off, and now you have two adult hydra right there. So people don't do that, right? Because you would be walking around, and all of a sudden you'd have this like growth on your side, and it would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it would pop off, and then there would be like another Eileen or somebody right there. Okay, that doesn't happen. Right. That's asexual reproduction. So what's the difference between this hydra here and the one that it came from? They're exactly the same. Okay, that is asexual reproduction. Well, when we think of reproduction in humans, right, it's really complicated, right? So there's two sexes. Some of us have a penis and testicles and scrotum. Others of us have vagina and uterus, ovaries, and all that kind of stuff. And it's really complicated. Why do we have all this complicated stuff in our bodies? What's the purpose of reproduction or our reproductive system in people? Right? I think it's interesting to think about that. Okay. And so here is a way that you can help understand that. So if you were to turn around and look in the room right now, would you find another you sitting there? If you looked around, would you find another you? Usually not, right? Okay, but certain processes, that can happen, but usually you don't see another you. What happens if you go, and even if you two, if you go to a football game and there's 100,000 people in the stadium like the Coliseum, and you look around, are you going to find another you in the Coliseum, 100,000 people? Are you going to find another you in there? No. Okay. And how about if you looked over the whole world? If you looked everywhere, at every single person, are you going to find another you? No. All right, so the function of the reproductive system is to produce something that's new and unique, right? Not just the same organism over and over and over again. And that diversity makes the population very strong. There was kind of a strange pathology that I mentioned when we got into the skeletal system. And it's kind of strange because it affects everybody in the population. Anybody remember what that disease process of the skeletal system is, if we're lucky enough to live old enough, that we all have to deal with? Females are a little bit more susceptible. And what is that process called? Osteoporosis. That's right, osteoporosis. So it's really strange for a disease process to affect everybody within a population because we are all different. Right? And so the purpose of sexual reproduction is to make sure that we're all different so that if there is some kind of disease process or infection going around, we don't all come down with it at the same time. Osteoporosis is really strange. There's one that another process we'll look at in the male reproductive system that will affect everybody, but it's really, really rare. Right? So if somebody comes down with a flu in here, we're not all going to catch it. Some of us are going to be more resistant, and that's because we are all different. And that's due to our reproductive system. OK, Okay. What about, think about this. So your parents produced you at some point in time, right? Could they produce another you maybe like 10 years later or 5 years later? Is that possible? Okay. I see some people shaking their heads no. And you know what? It has never happened, but it is possible. It is possible. If your parents produced you at some time, why can't they produce another you? Right? But the odds of that happening are just so astronomically high that it just can't happen. It just doesn't happen. Right? So the purpose of all these different kinds of organs, right, and sex cells is to produce diversity in a population to make it strong so that we all don't die at the same time for the same reason. Right? So some of us are going to survive no matter what. And that's an important part of diversity. So the purpose of the reproductive system is to produce, do I have it here? Produce new and unique offspring. Right? So you are unique and there'll probably never be another you again ever. Right? There's always going to be something different about other people that come after you. So that's the purpose of the reproductive system. We call that sexual reproduction, which is different than asexual reproduction, right? So for instance, if this parent hydra comes down with a disease, probably the offspring will as well. And then what happens to all the hydra? Well, they become extinct, right? So sexual reproduction protects against extinction. That's really important. All right, so I want you to know that reproductive system, because it's so complicated, there are good reasons for that, and the reasons are because it produces diversity, and that gives the population a lot of strength. One last thing I want to talk about before I really get into the anatomy is a safe haven law. It started in Texas 1999, and I've been talking about it since 1999. People never heard of it. Now a lot of people have heard of it. It's also called baby safe laws. Does anybody know anything about a baby safe law or safe haven laws? And there was just an example a couple of months ago of why it's a really important law. There's a baby that was found in a dumpster, newborn baby. Okay, I don't know where it was, but it was someplace in LA. And this law right here says that if you have a baby within, and it depends on the state, within 24 hours or 48 hours, if you take this newborn baby to a hospital or a fire station or a police station, then you can surrender that newborn baby without any kind of legal repercussions or criminal repercussions, right? You just surrender the baby and then that baby will be taken care of, right? So you don't have to worry about it. Because we all know that having a baby is a really stressful circumstance, situation, especially if you don't have family to help you with that. So somebody might be making some kind of poor decisions at that time. And so this law right here just says that if you can't take care of that baby, don't worry about it. Somebody else will be happy to take that baby and raise it for you, and you don't have to worry about it ever again. And so that's in LA County, that's called babysafela.org. And I think at the bottom of the slide over here, okay, there's a little flyer that describes it, okay? Newborns can be safely given up at any LA County hospital, emergency room, or fire station without any kind of consequence or judgment or anything placed upon you. So that's a great law that does save many, many lives. All right, so that's baby safe. Who has not ever heard of that law before? Raise your hand if you haven't heard of that. A couple of people haven't heard of it. Yeah, and that, so that's a really important law. So it's probably not so important for us, but maybe somebody you know, just pass the word around. And maybe you can save somebody's life. All right, let's move on. I'm going to turn some lights off in just a second. Okay, so what's the function of the reproductive system? Yeah, produce something new and unique, right? We're all new and unique. Well, most of us are unique. Some of us have a couple copies, but most of us are really unique. Let's see, I want that on, that off, that off, that. Why can't I get that one off? Oh, that switch isn't working. That's why. There. Okay. Okay, so let's start talking about some anatomy. We're going to look at two sexes. All right, so each of us have had a mom and a dad, maybe we don't have a mom and a dad right now, but at some point in time we did. And so we're the result of that union. We'll talk about how that happens. But first, we're going to talk about the male reproductive system. And sometimes I tell a joke about that, like this is the most important one, so that's why we're going to start with this one. But that's not necessarily true, right? Because it takes both. And where are these slides at? Okay, I'm going to put urinary system away. Good, so I don't get confused. Okay, the male reproductive system. Right here. Here's an exam figure. As a matter of fact, this is your quiz figure for labeling as well. All right, good. I'm all set to go. So here's the male reproductive system. And most of this stuff is in the pelvic cavity. There's some stuff that is extra pelvic. For instance, like this is the primary reproductive structure in the male. This is a testes. And the testes job is twofold. It produces something called gametes, and that's a sex cell. And it also produces hormones. As a matter of fact, not hormones, it produces one hormone, namely testosterone, right? And testosterone is a sex steroid that produces secondary male sex characteristics, right? And some secondary male sex characteristics and organs would be, for instance, epididymis, vas deferens, prostate gland, bulbo urethral gland, penis, seminal vesicles, and some other things, for instance, like more muscle mass, deeper voice, more hair that's coarse and in more locations on the body, and thicker, stronger bones as a result of testosterone. And testosterone comes from the testes right here. Well, what the heck is a gamete? Maybe I have to turn the lights back on. Does anybody know what a gamete is? Well, a ovary and testes produces gametes. All right, so there goes the nephron. And here is a male gamete, and here is a female gamete. And so this thing right here is what we call a sperm, right? So here's a sperm, and here is an egg. All right, and we call these sex cells because they're not like a normal cell inside our body. They have half the number of chromosomes. The usual number of chromosomes inside of our body is 46. All right, so these over here only have 23. All right, so here is 23 chromosomes, 23 chromosomes. When these things come together, it produces this cell right here, which we call a zygote. A zygote is a single cell product of this process. And what do we call this process when egg and sperm join together? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Unless you stayed up studying really, really late last night or something. This is called fertilization, right? Fertilization. All right, so now we have 46 chromosomes in here, and then this cell starts to divide, right? And divide and divide, and every single cell is going to have 46 chromosomes, and eventually you're going to end up with something big. What is this process called, going from a single cell to billions of cells? Okay, yeah, it's mitosis, right? Because all of these daughter cells over here are exactly like this one, all have 46 chromosomes, all right? So this is mitosis. All right, well, then how do we get from cells that have 46 chromosomes to cells that have 23. That's a different kind of process. That is what we call meiosis. Meiosis is a way to reduce the number of chromosomes in these different cells. Right? And that pretty much is the whole life cycle of a human. Right? Mitosis, meiosis, fertilization, on and on and on. So it's the job of this testes right here to produce a, oh, I didn't label it, gamete, right? So here are gametes. Here are gametes. And a male gamete is a sperm, and a female gamete is an egg. So the testes produces male gametes and testosterone. That's its job. The sperm right, are moved from the testes into a bunch of coiled tubes on the outside of the testes called the epididymis, and the sperm gains some competence to swim around and fertilize, and so this is a site of maturation, epididymis, and storage. During ejaculation, the sperm then move out of the epididymis into the vas deferens, and notice where the vas deferens goes. Right? It starts in, not in the pelvic cavity, but in the scrotum, which is external to the pelvic cavity. And there's a very important reason for that. And that is the process that makes those sperm is called spermatogenesis. Spermatogenesis can only take place at a lower than normal body temperature. It has to be cooler. And if it is not cooler, there's actually some really terrible consequences. If this testes stays in the pelvic cavity, doesn't descend into the scrotum, more than likely it's going to turn cancerous very quickly. Right? And if this testes is hidden in the pelvic cavity, we call that cryptorchidism. Crypt means hidden, and an ovary and a testes, another way of talking about them is that they're both orchids. Right? Cryptorchidism, the testes doesn't descend, stays warm, turns cancerous, and of course that is, well, that's deadly. People that raise animals at home, like dogs and cats, if it's a male, you always check to see if both testes descend into the scrotum, because if not, then you're going to lose that animal very early to testicular cancer. Okay. All right, so sperm move from epididymis into the vas deferens, up through the inguinal canal, over the top of the urinary bladder, and they pass through, or pass by, another organ that we call the seminal vesicle. And the seminal vesicle adds volume to the ejaculate. We're going to talk about what that volume does. And then that volume moves through the prostate gland. Prostate gland adds additional volume to the ejaculate along with the sperm. Then we see that the reproductive tract, the vas deferens, actually joins with the urethra. All right, so here's urinary bladder. Here's the urethra taking urine outside of the body through the penis. So here's the external urethral orifice. So in the male reproductive system, the reproductive system and urinary system do form one particular unit. Right? That doesn't ever happen in the female, but it does in the male. Right? As the ejaculate passes through the urethra, then here is another gland that adds some volume to it. This is the bulbourethral gland, and it mostly secretes mucus, and even before ejaculation, into the urethra. And mucus has a couple different functions. It's a lubricant, which helps with penetration, but it also inhibits bacterial growth, number two. And number three, it helps neutralize acids that are in the female vagina and the male urethra, because that acid can inactivate sperm motility. All right, so that helps sperm motility. All right, so here is the urinary bladder. Urethra that passes through the prostate gland is called the prostatic urethra. There is a floor of the pelvic cavity that we call the perineum, and it has muscles in it, and we call this the membranous urethra as it passes through the perineum. And then when the urethra enters the penis, we call this the penile urethra or the spongy urethra, because this erectile tissue in the penis, it acts like a sponge. Right? It can engorge with blood and produce an erection. So we call this the penile or spongy urethra. And you notice, because the spongy urethra is very long compared to, and we haven't looked at this just yet, the female urethra, males rarely suffer from urinary tract infections or bladder infections. The female urethra is very short, and so it's easy for infections or bacteria to get up into the bladder. All right, so here is that prostate gland. And this prostate gland can become diseased. If we are lucky enough to live old enough, there are a couple of disease processes. And every male, if you're lucky enough to live a long life, you're going to have to deal with the consequences of just this nature of the prostate. It has a tendency to grow and enlarge. We call that hypertrophy. When it grows and enlarges, guess what happens to the diameter of this urethra that is passing through it? It shrinks. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So as men get older, they have more difficulty voiding. Right? So that's one of the consequences of a hypertrophic prostate gland. Have trouble voiding. You can void a little bit, right? And then an hour later, you feel an urgency, you have to void again. And that can be very disruptive if you're doing that all night long. And that is not a terribly dangerous condition, right? It's a benign condition, but there's even a worse condition, and that is prostate glands have a tendency to become cancerous, just like if this testes remained in the pelvic cavity. So prostatic cancer is very dangerous and deadly. And as a matter of fact, like I said, every man, if we live long enough, we either have a hypertrophic prostate or a cancerous prostate. And why is that so strange? Why is that so strange? That every man is going to, not woman, because they don't have a prostate gland, but every man has to deal with that pathology. Because we produce, how? How do we reproduce? We produce sexually or asexually? Sexually. And what does sexual reproduction, what does sexual reproduction produce? Something new and unique, right? And it's supposed to protect the population from everybody coming down with the same disease process at the same time, right? So sexual reproduction is supposed to protect against this abnormal prostate gland, either hypertrophic or cancerous prostate, but nonetheless it still happens. And it kind of reminds me of osteoporosis, right? Osteoporosis is another one of those disease processes that has slipped by the production of sexual reproduction. All right, so that's a prostate gland. The penis has a couple different kinds of cavernous tissues, and the dorsal part right here is what we call the corpus cavernosum, and there is one. The ventral part over here is the corpus spongiosum. That's what the spongy urethra goes through. And, well, you know what? And it also makes the glans penis right here. It has one division, and I think I misspoke. The corpus cavernosum, there are actually two. There's one that's right and one that's left. And if you talk about one, it's corpus cavernosum. If you talk about both, it's called corpora cavernosa. Right? Corpora cavernosa means plural because there's one on either side. All right, so just remember, the corpus cavernosa, or the corpora cavernosa, are dorsal, and the ventral part is the corpus spongiosum. The corpus spongiosum, right, goes very deep into the perineum, and here's the bulb of the penis, which kind of anchors the penis in position, so it doesn't move around too much. And glans penis. Over the glans penis, we have some protective skin called the prepuce. And here's the scrotum outside the the pelvic cavity. And I think that pretty much describes everything on this particular slide. Anybody have a question about what I talked about so far on this slide? No question? I usually get a question. The question is, why does the corpus spongiosum, why do we call that the ventral part of the penis? Because it looks like it's dorsal. Why is that? Because in anatomic position, the penis is erect. And when the penis is erect, where is this tissue? It is ventral, not dorsal. Okay? Okay. Okay, so that is just a nice sagittal section. Let's look at some anatomy of testes. Oh, but before we get there, here's a really good slide. All right, so here we have a penis. Here's the scrotum. We see a number of different layers, right? There's some muscle, like the cremaster muscle. Then we've got some skin, and then there's a little dartos muscle as well that can contract the size of the scrotum. Various layers, like a tunica vaginalis. Vaginalis just means a covering of something. And it's a covering of the spermatic cord and the testes. And here I see the spermatic cord. Well, what do we see in the spermatic cord? You see something blue in there. Yes, that is the testicular vein. Do you see something red in there? Maybe there's something red in there. That's the testicular artery. And there's also a tube that sperm goes through. That's the vas deferens. Maybe I can see it, but it's going right through here. But do you see something yellow in there as well? Yeah, that's a testicular nerve. All right, so the testicular nerve, testicular artery, testicular vein, and the vas deferens, as well as the cremaster muscle, make something that we call the spermatic cord. So the spermatic cord is something that connects the testes to the pelvic cavity. Now, when you look at this blue blood vessel, the testicular vein, does it look just like a single straight blood vessel, or does it look like a plexus? Does it look like a network? Just a simple straight vessel or a network, the blue one right here? It looks like a network, and that's really important. That network is what we call the pampiniform venous plexus. And the pampiniform venous plexus is surrounding the testicular artery, right? And it's right up against it. So that when warm blood comes down the testicular artery, it would bring all that heat into the testes right here, and that wouldn't help the testes, and that would actually inhibit spermatogenesis. But because the testicular artery is right up against this testicular vein or the pampiniform plexus, the blood in the pampiniform plexus is cold because it's been out of the body cavity for a long time. So when the venous blood goes back into the body, it cools down the arterial supply to the testes. So it's like a radiator system, right? It's a special heat exchange mechanism to make sure that arterial blood getting to the testes is not at normal body temperature, but it's cooler than that. So that's kind of an interesting little thing right there. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to show you on here. Just make sure you know that the spermatic cord has all of those components. Cremaster muscle, testicular artery, testicular vein, vas deferens, which I see right here is the vas deferens, and testicular nerve. And there's a special arrangement between the testicular vein and testicular artery. Okay. All right, so here we see that pampiniform plexus once again surrounding the testicular artery, and we have a nice illustration of what a testes looks like, along with some epididymis here as well. All right, so here is the fibrous capsule of the testes. We call the tunica vaginalis, and there are some small tubes inside the testes that we call seminiferous tubules. There are seminiferous tubules, and inside these tubules is where sperm are produced, so spermatogenesis takes place in these tubules, and these tubules are grouped into different lobes, and there are septations or walls between these different lobes of the testes. All right, so sperm is produced in these seminiferous tubules, and they move into the straight tubule, and then into the Reedy's testes, and then into this little efferent ductule, and then finally into the epididymis. So there are a bunch of little tubes, and in the epididymis, right, that's where they mature, gain competence, and they just wait there until ejaculation takes place. All right, let's take a look at a seminiferous tubule. All right, so here's a seminiferous tubule. I see some cells inside the tubule, as well as some sperm inside the tubule, and then I see some cells that are outside or between the tubules. These are what we call interstitial cells. There's one kind of interstitial cell, and interstitial cells sometimes are called cells of Leydig. These are the ones responsible for producing testosterone. The ones inside the seminiferous tubule are there to produce sperm, but not to produce testosterone. So there are germ cells that produce sperm, and then there are other kinds of cells that support spermatogenesis. They support the maturation of sperm cells, and those are called Sertoli cells. All right, so outside the seminiferous tubules, you have interstitial cells that produce testosterone. Inside the tubule, you have germ cells that produce sperm, and then Sertoli cells that support spermatogenesis. Okay, and don't forget, a spermatocyte or a sperm is also called a gamete. I don't know if you have to know this or not. Just look at the end of the chapter. But a Sertoli cell, the more modern name for a Sertoli cell inside the seminiferous tubule, is what we call a sustentacular cell. It supports spermatogenesis. All right, the interstitial cells produce testosterone. All right, so you should be able to trace a sperm as it's being produced. Where does it start? It starts in the seminiferous tubule, goes through a straight tubule, into the Reedy's testes, into an efferent ductule, into the epididymis, right? And then during ejaculation goes into the vas deferens, through the spermatic cord, into the pelvic cavity. And let's finish it up by pulling this slide up, right? So the vas deferens then turns into the ejaculatory duct inside the prostate gland, and that's where it joins up with the urethra, where urine is carried out of the urinary bladder. So it joins up with the prostatic urethra, and then it passes through the membranous urethra, passes through the spongy or penile urethra, and then outside the body. So that is the trace of what sperm have to go through to get out of the body. Okay. So that's the sperm. The ducts we talked about, epididymis, we looked at that, the vas deferens, right, forms a spermatic cord with the artery and some muscle and vein and nerve. The ampulla of the vas deferens is that swelling as it joins with the seminal or passes by the seminal vesicle. So here's the ampulla. It adds ejaculate volume to the ejaculate along with the seminal vesicle. All right, so let's look at some of the what are the volumes of these different glands, what they secrete into the ejaculate. So seminal vesicle, relatively large gland, and it forms about 60% of the semen volume. Some of its components is fructose, that's a sugar, and that's an energy molecule that spermatocytes need to swim around with their flagellum. There's prostaglandins from the seminal vesicle that stimulate uterine contractility, so that helps propel sperm from vagina through the uterus up toward an ovary. And we haven't looked at the female reproductive system yet, but I'll mention that. There are agents that enhance sperm motility besides fructose. There are immunosuppressants because these sperm, once they enter the female body, they don't belong to the female body, so the female might actually reject them with an immune response. And of course, that wouldn't be very helpful for conception. There are semen coagulants, so that when semen is placed in a vagina, it just doesn't run right out. So semen has a tendency to coagulate in the vagina and then slowly dissolve away so that sperm are slowly released. And then there are some pigments in the seminal vesicle, and really nobody knows what that pigment is there for. But that's a sure marker of semen. Right? With ultraviolet light, it fluoresces very brightly. Okay, the prostate gland forms about 30% of the semen volume. It has a neutralizing solution, so it neutralizes acid in the spongy urethra, neutralizes acid in the vagina. That acid will decrease sperm motility. There are also motility agents, there are some more coagulants, and there's then after a time, there's something that will dissolve that semen plug or that coagulated semen plug in the vagina down, and that we call these liquefying agents. We call these prostatic or PSA prostatic specific antigens, which will then slowly release and activate sperm once they're in the vagina. Bulbourethral gland, a very small amount of volume, about 5%, secretes mucus for lubrication and neutralization of acids that are in the reproductive tract. Okay, and also also prevent infection. Urethra. Urethra's got those three parts, prostatic, membranous, and spongy. The erectile tissue, there are two kinds of erectile tissue. Let me find a good slide of the erectile tissues in the penis, coming right up. Ah, that's pretty good, bless you. All right. All right, so here is the dorsal penis, and here are the corpora cavernosa, there are two. Here is the spongy, corpus spongiosum, and here's where the urethra goes through. Here are just some deep blood vessels. These are not urethra. Okay. And if we go back one slide, this might be an exam figure. I can't remember for sure. But it shows us a little bit different perspective of the ampulla of the ductus deferens. Where's the vas deferens? Oh, here's a vas deferens coming over here. Vas deferens coming over here. Seminal vesicles add volume to the ejaculate through the ejaculatory duct and the prostate gland. Then it enters the prostatic urethra through the membranous urethra in the urogenital diaphragm. Here are the bulbourethral glands on either side. And we have the crus of the penis, the bulb of the penis, which is deep in the body cavity. And then the two corpora cavernosa, the corpus spongiosum, where the urethra goes through, and then the glans penis. All right, so that's it for male reproductive system. And I think next time, I'm going to stop there. Next time we're going to talk about female reproductive system. And I think we're going to get into a little bit more endocrinology when we talk about the female reproductive tract. And the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. But you should also remember, what's the function of the reproductive system? Not to reproduce, but to do what? Make something that's new and unique. New and unique, right? Okay. The function of the reproductive system is to produce diversity. Sorry.